Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is indeed a beautiful day. I want to thank the ladies and gentlemen for the beautiful special music. I need to tell you a little about Mr. Helge when it comes to announcements. When Mr. Helge gets announcements in front of him, he lays them all out. He takes out a legal brief to the left side and starts writing notes, does highlights on the announcements. And if you've ever seen a legal brief, there's numbers down the side by sentence, by paragraph, and he numbers every one of the lines on those notes and makes sure he doesn't skip everything. So he does a very thorough job. I was kidding about the legal notes. But if you think I'm going to ever threaten a lawyer, my mom didn't raise an idiot. On a serious note, John Ross Schroeder is indeed a loss. They're not going to replace him. So it would be good if we maybe collectively sent a card. And I didn't know if Mr. Helge was going to tell you about Andrew Kavanis, but I thought he'd give a little bit, but I wanted to give you a little bit of background. I received a text. It's good news, by the way, for those of you who don't. How many of you know about the Andrew Kavanis missing in action? Oh, quite a few of you. As you know, Justin Kavanis, our fifth child, now is staying with us, and so we had a ringside view of what was occurring. And he texted us. He's in a master's program, and we live close to where he's attending, so he's graced us with his presence, and it's been an absolute delight. But he texted about Wednesday in the morning and said, "I appreciate your prayers for my bro, Andrew. He didn't come home last night, and he's missing." And obviously, he was very, very concerned. And he was gone for a total of 3 days and two nights, not quite 3 days and three nights. And it got very, very troubling through most of it, as a lot of you know. But the word spread among about 20 to 30. We're not really even sure how many people were involved, but people got plane tickets from Northern California, I think one other state, and flew in to help. It was that serious. And he had gone, as he is wont to do, hiking. It had been raining, and he got it in his head that he would like to take a hike into an area where he could see waterfalls and pools of water. And that's what he loves to do. And to make a very long story short, he did find the pool of water and the waterfalls, came out, it was getting late, and he got lost, completely disoriented. And he's an experienced hiker. But the word spread among the 20 to 30 or more young adults and others in the various organizations. And they texted with each other, called each other, Facebooked each other. And by Wednesday, there was quite a few people looking in the various areas where they knew Andrew was frequenting. And he was found alive on Thursday, in which there was great rejoicing. But I think it was, and you'll hear throughout the next couple of weeks, because quite a few of the people, some of the people are here that were a part of the search. A couple of them are not, and they will be here in the next couple of Sabbaths, and you can bludgeon them with all the different questions. But it is an amazing series of miraculous events. Andrew was deep in this hiking trail. He was able to find a creek hours later and was able to follow that creek. He found or encountered a bear. And if any of you know, Andrew has a very large, bushy hair. And I can imagine after 2 days, he was pretty scary looking. And that bear took off, I guess, in the opposite direction, per the story. He also found a discarded backpack, which contained peanut butter, a sleeping bag, I kid you not, and a few other items. He has no idea why it was there, but he found it along the stream bed. And so God was truly is a miraculous God. It's a testament also to our young people. And they got together from various parts of the area and even parts of the state, and they worked together with the sheriff's department. They, in fact, after 2 days of searching, found Andrew's car at the trailhead and directed the sheriff's helicopter, the rescue search and rescue helicopter, to the area where Andrew was. But I won't take any more time. A lot of you know the story, and I'm sure they're going to be talking about it after services today and the weeks together. But it was, again, a very important point where these kids prayed together, they searched together, and I guess with some crying. So it was a good result. This indeed has been is an exciting time of year for all of us in the church. It's an exciting week after what we've just described, and not only with the Kavanis issue, but also with the health battles that various people are facing. So it's been a very lively week. But it is indeed a fascinating time of year, is it not? The weather is changing. The seasons are segueing. I know it's difficult in Californians, but we Californians, and I'm a native. How many of you are native Californians? Why are you all sitting mainly on this side of the room? Anyway. But we Californians watch for subtle changes. There's really no snow, not close to us. We have to drive to it. But this is our rainy season, finally. I think the prayer would be, God, thanks for the rain. Could we just not get it all at once? But it is a beautiful time. I talked to the Halls this morning, and they said, you know, the drive-in to the Pasadena area would be beautiful, and it was indeed a very lovely drive. But we do. Do you know the Californians have four seasons? I bet you didn't know that. We do. We have torrential rains, mudslides, wildfires, and earthquakes, and not all quite in that order. But this is also the spiritual season. And it seems like it has started a little bit early. In a few weeks, we will begin the Holy Day season as biblically commanded. And part of this message is a slight reminder for the young and some of the new that are with us. Because the beginning of the Holy Day season begins first and always first with Passover. And not a holy day per se, it's extremely special, as we know in its own right. It is a part of, connected to, the days of unleavened bread. The time commemorates the Exodus. That is what its focus is. The time the Israelites were delivered by God from the Egyptians and from slavery. And part of the days of unleavened bread, where we put leaven out of our homes, is the wave sheaf offering. So for 1 week or 8 days, it is one of the most concentrated areas of holy days and spiritual meaning. The fall holy days are very important, but they are spread out much more than the spring holy days are. This was a very concentrated time of the season of the year that we're going into. And so today what I'd like to do is talk to you about entering history, as we do every year in the spring, collectively and individually, where we will discuss the pivotal aspects of the Exodus and how it applies to us from both a historical and an individual perspective. Where we indeed actually enter history. We will hover, for the most part, at around 40,000 feet. We will look at just kind of the high points, the mountains, as it were, for most of this message. And indeed, it will not start in Matthew, but I'll end in Matthew. So we'll see the mountaintops, but we'll end with the drilling down to the ground level as we finish, as we end. So let me give you a preface. The Exodus as a historical event, and many of us have studied it for many, many decades, it occupies two important relationships in biblical history, and they are critical. Number one, it is the most oft-repeated theme, or most oft-referred to event in the entire Bible. There are few books of the Bible, aside from Genesis, there is rarely a book or chapter that does not have a hint of the Passover or the Exodus. It is so critical, as we know, there is an entire book and two other books, parts of books, that are devoted to the singular event of the Exodus. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of references to the Exodus in the Bible. You will hear phrases like, up from Egypt, I delivered you out of the house of bondage, with a strong hand God delivered his people, out of Egypt, out of slavery. And from Exodus to Revelation, the Exodus theme is echoed explicitly and in type. Sometimes it's a little hidden, but it's worth the dig. And so it's important to see and understand these phrases and concepts, because if you do realize them, the meaning of the Exodus and therefore the Passover becomes all the more concrete. The other important point to understand is that when we read and we listen to these verses we're going to be talking about, I want you to read them in the Old Testament text, or what we call the Old Testament, but I want you to read them with what your spiritual understanding allows you, living in the year 2014, the 21st century, with all the background and knowledge that you've gained your entire life. So as we read these, think about what else it means besides the literal event. The other issue with Exodus, the date and the very historical fact that the Exodus occurred, is the most contested event in the entire Bible. I'm not sure you knew that. It is the Exodus that is the most discussed from every aspect, archaeological, historical, biblical, religiously. It is the most contested event in the Bible. There are three major schools of thought. There are others. The Exodus was possibly a historical event that occurred in the 13th century or 1260 BC. That's known as old chronology. There is the theory of an Exodus in the 1400s or 15th century, around 1455 to 1490 BC, and that is the majority opinion in the United Church of God and most of the churches of God. But the third opinion, and it is the prevalent opinion, is that the event never, ever occurred. It is a myth. It is a story. It has no basis in historical fact. The controversy, those that believe that it is a historical event against those who do not, have reached in the last 20 to 30 years an epic proportion of battle. Those that feel it is a historical event against those that are known, that do not. It is against the standard Egyptian chronology. It is a very detailed, very exhaustive search. It's over my head in the main. But Egyptian chronology has now been called into question. The literature is vast. It is complex. It is all over the web. I might refer you to a few authors if you have any interest, but you better have your Bible in one hand and a dictionary in the other as you read David Rohl's book, R-O-H-L, Howard Bimson, and Robert Porter. And these men know Egyptology, they know archaeology, and they know their Bible. Well, what's interesting, not all, but many of these men are atheists, or they're agnostics at best. They see the Bible, however, as an accurate biblical document of history, that the events, the people, and the places are all real, and it needs to be taken much more seriously as you would any historical document, and tested whether it is real or myth. So that is interesting. We kind of sit in some ways in the grandstands because the church does not have archaeological or Egyptological scholars in this realm. It is interesting. They posit these, what we call new chronology archaeologists and Egyptologists, they posit the traditional, for the last 200 years, Egyptian chronology is highly flawed and suspect. It's known as the second, if you want to Google new chronology or second intermediate period, it's off by some 300 years. If it is off by 300 years, the new chronology of Egypt lines up within 4 to 5 years, often to the exact year, of what we believe of the biblical events, the people, and the archaeology. Now, I know what you're thinking, that this is going to be a problem. The problem is that, you're right, Yul Brynner and Cedric Hardwick were not the pharaohs of the Exodus. There was a joke in there somewhere. But seriously, the issue is highly argued, highly debated, and the clash of the titans, as I call it academically, is ongoing. It's liable to hit ahead in the next 2 or 3 years. But the bottom line is that the Egyptian records, and in fact mirrors the biblical history of the Exodus in the Bible. And this understanding, I think, is critical to our younger folk, who are bombarded constantly with the idea, as we are, we older folk in the media, but they get it in school, of the myth stories of the Bible. If the idea of the Exodus falls, the New Testament falls with it. And you understand why. But I don't think it will. So if you want to do some study, where indeed some cutting-edge science is coming to bear, and proving the Bible as an incredibly accurate, incredibly detailed account of what really happened. That's the show you want to see. Turn with me, if you would, if you never thought I would get into God's Word. Turn with me, if you would. Guess where? No, not Matthew. Exodus chapter 1. I don't know, Dave Delamater's right. There are books, don't you agree? There's books you just feel comfortable with, right? There's other books we love. I love the book of Exodus. It's fascinating. There's some books you just feel a little bit more at home with. So you always go home, don't you? So not to give away too much, we'll be ending in Matthew. Let me give you a real quick recap before we hit Exodus chapter 1. One of the 12 sons of Jacob, Joseph, is carried off to Egypt, where he becomes an official to the Pharaoh of Egypt. Joseph and his family, for many, many years, as he rises among the administration of Pharaoh in Egypt, he enjoys very, very special favor. So Joseph was part of the administration, one of Pharaoh's right-hand men. And with that background, we begin Exodus chapter 1. Verse 1, now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man in his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, verse 6, all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty. And the land was filled with them, the Israelites. And that's great. They're getting bigger. They're being fruitful and multiply. The Genesis command, be fruitful and multiply, they did. From 70, over the decades, they grew and they grew and they grew in number. However, there's a but in the story. There always is. Verse 8, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. That is a catchphrase for the younger people. In business, we use the phrase, I don't know how many of you have heard it, when you get a new boss, you'll say, oh, there has arisen in Egypt a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, right? Well, anybody who knows their Bible means we got a new boss. So everything that was done in the past means nothing. You start all over again. You've got to prove yourself all over again because there's a new boss, a new Pharaoh. And so within this story, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them. We'll see how shrewdly. Lest they multiply and it happen, in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up. Go up out of the land. Very important phrase. Go up out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, they sent taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities of Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the Israelites, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. Now, that's a King James phrase that the New King James, because of it's so descriptive, was carried over. So they made them serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. They were building their monuments. And their service in which they made them was with rigor. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the other name was Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, I mean, you get this visual, right? And at the time, and even today, we have midwives, and they would help the pregnant woman deliver her child, and they had a birth stool. It's very common in that part of the world. We were in Hawaii a few years ago, and they have what's called a birth stool made out of stone. And it's where the expectant mother would sit in an inclining position to help the delivery of the child. It looks crude by our standards. It says, if you see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, kill it. But if it is a daughter, then let it live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. And so how did he know? There's all these male babies running around. That's how he knew. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing? Done what? You're letting the male children live of the Hebrews. You've saved the male children alive. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, these young boys are just too quick. They pop out faster than we can get there. That's the Garnet translation. Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Yeah, you're right. That's kind of a fib. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was the midwives feared God. They provided households for them. God protected them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Now, we don't know the ages, but I want you to think where else this happened. I'm not going to tell you. I want you to think where else this happened. And you will see parallel after parallel after parallel with other stories in the Bible. We don't know at what age. It's speculative as to how old the child, the male child, were that were being drowned. Drowned, by the way, in the Nile. In the Nile, which was a sacred river to the Egyptians. And so they were to kill them in the water. And so chapter 2, verse 1 enters Moses. Now, we are not going to, just to warn you ahead of time, we are not going to read every chapter, I promise. We're just going to hit the high points. And in chapter 2, verse 1, and a man of the house of Levi went out and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of the bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds of the riverbank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. I mean, can you get this beautiful image in your mind about, as you read this, this beautiful story about this woman who's trying to protect her child? She wants him to live, but has to let him go, and sets him in this little basket on the river. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when they opened it, they saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. She had compassion on them and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. It was a male child, so I'll let you figure out how they knew it was a male child. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? And they said, go. And that's how Moses arrives on the scene. Moses, as an adult, realizes later that he is a Hebrew. And we know many of us do that story. He was a Hebrew, and he was of the slave stock. The people that were the slaves of Egypt were his family, were his relatives. He flees Egypt. In chapter 3, if you move there with me, he flees to Midian. He marries. He is a tender of flocks. He's a herder. He sees a burning bush, and he meets God. We'll pick up the story in chapter 3 and in verse 3. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside. He is in the mountain of Horeb. I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Eternal saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him and from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. This is the first, technically the first recorded words in the book of Exodus. So when the Eternal saw that he turned to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. So he's talking directly, really, for the really kind of the first time to Moses. This is where it begins. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near to this place. Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place you stand is holy. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Eternal said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people. God was watching it all along. I've seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up. There's that phrase again. To bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hevites, the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. There's that phrase again. Out of Egypt. Now, by this time, Moses is listening to God. He probably He's got his head buried into the ground because he doesn't want to look up. He says, I've heard the people cry. I've heard the Israelites under the oppression of the Egyptians, and I'm going to do something about it. And Moses, you know, as we would all, he's nodding. This is good. This is great. You're going to free the people. They're under subjection. They're in slavery. This is horrible. It's been going on a long time. And then he says, I'm going to use you. I imagine the head nodding stopped, and he said, what? What? And Moses said to God, sure, I'm your guy. Send me. No, he didn't. He said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Question mark, question mark, question mark. So God said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I've sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. That was a prophecy. It was a prophecy. He goes on to say later in verse 18, they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, to Pharaoh, to the Egyptian Pharaoh, quote, the eternal God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please let us go. Very significant. This is one of the side purposes of the whole issue of the Exodus. Let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Eternal, our God. In the Bible study that we had earlier today, the sacrifice was very, very important. It was part of what we'll see later as the feast day. And so it says that indeed, let the people go so that they may worship God. They may worship God, they may give a sacrifice, so we can have a feast, as it says in other sections. And so indeed, he goes to Pharaoh, and he talks to Pharaoh. Move with me, if you would, to chapter 5. So he encounters Pharaoh. He goes with Aaron. Chapter 5, we'll pick it up in verse 1. Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, quote, thus says the eternal God of Israel, the famous phrase, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. That was the point, so that they could hold a feast. A feast with sacrifice. And Pharaoh said, sure, no problem. How long you need? He said, who is the eternal that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the eternal, nor will I let Israel go. So they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Eternal our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or the sword. Then the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? You're a pain in the neck. You're a nuisance. Get back to your labor. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. This is Pharaoh saying, by the way, in 21st century parlance, you've stopped production. This is going to cost you. You're slowing things down. I have buildings and monuments to build to my greatness and my glory. They were monument builders. And if you've ever seen any, how many of you have been to Egypt? A few of you have. I have not. It's one place I'd love to go. But they built monuments, hundreds and hundreds of monuments all over Egypt. So he says, you're stopping production. And you make them rest from their labor, verse 6. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, quote, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Now remember, a brick, a mud brick, to bind it, has to have something organic in it. And straw they would use. The straw would kind of hold it together as a binder. He says, so you shall no longer give the people. Now he's saying this, understand, of the taskmasters, because they would glean the fields and bring the straw. Bring us before, let them go, uses that phrase. I'm wondering, this is the way my mind works, if he's being sarcastic here. Yeah, we'll let the people go. Let the people go and gather straw for themselves. And you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore, they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. These men, Moses and Aaron, those are the ones speaking the false words. They are liars. And the taskmasters, verse 10, of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. It's a little bit of a change. We're not sure what happened in between. Maybe this was on the taskmaster side. Go, get yourself straw where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced. So the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. And the taskmasters forced them to hurrying, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw. And the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not fulfilled your task in making bricks, both yesterday and today as before? Verse 15, it gets worse. The officers of the children of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, saying, why are you dealing with us, your servants? There's no straw given to your servants. And they say to make us make brick. And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people. He said, you are lazy. Lazy. Therefore, you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Eternal. Therefore, go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, and you shall deliver the quota of bricks. And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it was said, you shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. So everybody's hurt by this. Can you imagine how the Israelites felt to Moses and Aaron? Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for all the help. Appreciate it. Any more suggestions? Keep them to yourself. It's horrible. It's horrible. They came out from Pharaoh, verse 20, and they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, let the Eternal look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. He is not going to let the people go. And as we know, there began the plagues. And Moses, God through Moses, began to call down 9 plagues. The 9 plagues included hail and fire and blood and frogs, highly descriptive. He did it so that Pharaoh would relent. But what did it do? It hardened Pharaoh's heart all the more. It is becoming desperate. It's becoming increasingly worse. But the 10th plague is the worst. Turn with me, if you would, all the way over to Exodus chapter 11. In Exodus chapter 11, the Eternal said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out. He'll get rid of you. Speak now in the hearing of the people, and let every man ask of his neighbor, every woman from her neighbor, articles of silver and articles of gold, because you're going to be leaving quick. And the Eternal gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Verse 4, then Moses said, thus says the Eternal. Moses has now been given this from God, so he's speaking on God's behalf. Thus says the Eternal, about midnight I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. There shall be a great cry throughout all the land, such as was not like it before, nor shall it be again. But against none of the children of Israel shall the dog move its tongue, against man or beast, that you may know the Eternal makes a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. And we know what happens. There was indeed a death of all the firstborn, from man to beast. But how were the Israelites saved? How were the Israelites, and how did God make a distinction between the Egyptians, the animals, and the Israelites? In chapter 12, verse 1, now the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, in the land of Egypt, this month shall be a beginning of months. It's the month of Abib, or the month of Nisan. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And he goes on to say, he says, verse 7, you'll kill it, you'll take the blood. Verse 7, and you shall take some of that blood and put it on the 2 doorposts and on the lintel on the houses where they eat it. And then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Not raw nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. You shall let none of it remain till morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist and sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, so shall you eat it in haste. It is the Eternal's Passover. And that's where it is called Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike the firstborn in the land. And that he did. But note the terms here. It is an extremely simple meal. It is an extremely simple elements contained in the meal. The blood of a small, innocent animal. He's to put it on the doorposts and the lintel. Right? The doorposts and the lintel. What about the windows? What about the windows? What about a roof opening? Those aren't covered. So it's very symbolic. Highly symbolic. When you do it to a doorpost, the front door, it was to be seen. It was to be observed, as we know, by the death angel. He was to look. All he had to do was look, and he would pass by. All he had to do was see it on the front door, the blood of that very, very simple animal. The verse 14, it says, "So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance." So the crux of the Exodus as history really relates to one single night. A few hours, in fact, with a small animal, a lamb, in most cases. And that small animal, the blood, and how it was used, turned the most powerful nation in that area, maybe in the world at the time, to its knees. And for 3,500 years, this observance commemorates that single historic event of that one night that set everything in motion and God saving his people. But the story doesn't end there, as we know. Along the way, it was recharacterized, reenacted, it was redefined, and even greater meaning for history. And so, guess where we're going now? You get one guess, you get only one guess. You're right, the book of Matthew. So in Matthew chapter 26, if you'll turn there with me, in verse 17, some 1,500 years after the Exodus, after the first Passover, we see some men who are about to prepare. Verse 17, chapter 26. "Now on the first of unleavened bread," the word day of the feast is added, "on the first of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him," now what? Notice the words of what we call convergence, similarities. "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he said, "Go into the city to a certain man and to say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep Passover at your house with my disciples.'" This is one of those things where I would love to know who this man is. Nothing is said about him. Not one word. "So go see a man. Tell him, I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples." So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. It is the Passover. Again, a very simple meal. The word Passover is repeated over and over again. Drop down to chapter, verse 26. "And as they were eating this very simple meal, Jesus looked around, and of the things that were on the table, he picked up bread, blessed it, broke it, gave it to the disciples, and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' He took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine from now until that day when I see it anew with you in my Father's kingdom.'" So he has, in some cases, in some ways, changed the elements, and that is for another time. We know the story. The blood, again, was used, this time not from a single animal, but from a single person. But we still see the typology of the lamb at Passover. This will, my counting is right, this will be my 40th year and my 39th Passover. And so technically, to use the years of wandering, I'm still kind of wandering. 39 years, still trying to get it all straight. Now, any technical questions you may have about this message, we're going to defer to Mr. Helge. Mr. Helge has more than 40 Passovers, so he has entered in kind of like a Canaan. He's entered into a different area and a better place. But you know, with all those Passovers behind us, this never, ever becomes old. It's never ceased to be a meaningful requirement. And it's only once a year. There are other churches who take this event very seriously. They call it communion. It was once a month, as I took it when I was in the Protestant church. Our SDA friends, usually once a quarter. Catholics, often weekly, sometimes they can daily. And it's called the Lord's Table, Communion, Eucharist, Holy Communion. Those are descriptive titles. They all technically mean the same thing. But to me, it's Passover. The Israelites called it as such. Jesus called it Passover. It's good enough for me. It reminds us with that word of the history and the millennial old, the thousands and thousands of years, this connection, because we enter history collectively with the Exodus and individually as we take the symbols of the bread and the wine. Tell you a quick story. I got a call, yesterday, early in the morning, and it was from a guy I kind of work for, and he's an administrator in one of the county offices of education. He asked me, he sounded sick. He says, I know you don't work on Saturdays, but would you mind filling in for me? I got a major presentation at the county, and I just can't do it. I said, I'm sorry, I can't. I just can't. And he said, I understand. I said, in fact, I have duties tomorrow, today. And he said, what are you doing? Well, I don't talk about it. I said, I have to give a presentation. So that's what this is. It's a presentation. He said, well, I have a personal question for you. And I'm bracing for impact. I work for this guy. And at 7:45 in the morning, I'm saying, ugh, what is he calling? It's 7:15 in the morning. And he said, what do you know about Nissen and Suckett? I said, excuse me? And he said, do you mean Nissen and Sukkot? Yeah, that's what I meant. I said, a little bit. What's the question? He says, what do you know what's going to happen on April 14th and 15th and October 8th and 9th? I'm thinking in my head, well, I know when Passover is. I said, well, when's Passover? And I figured the other question had to do with, I said, the Feast of Tabernacles. That's Sukkot or Sukkot, as you called it. And he says, you know about this stuff? And I said, yeah. By the way, this guy lives in Escondido. I said, when I go down every year after year, to Escondido, that's the Feast of Tabernacles. So you know about this stuff? I said, yeah. He says, what do you know about blood moons? I said, I don't know a lot. I know a little bit. What's the question? He says, and he proceeded to tell me, indeed, there will be eclipses, for those of you that know about a blood moon. There will be two this year and two next year. What's odd is they will be on the high holy days. And this isn't the time or the place. And the church has literature on it, so this is not my point. But if you focus on the blood moons, and those of you that know what they are, you'll miss my point. It's not about blood moons. He said to me, can you give me some information on this? I'm very concerned. Obviously, he just spent the last 20 minutes explaining it to me. And I said, well, I'll have to get back to you. I'm a little rusty. I know astronomically what they are, but I'm going to need to. And he was concerned. I said, let me get back to you. He said, well, my pastor at church, he blew me off. Told me it wasn't important. Now, whether it is or it isn't, that's not the point. It's not the point. We try and always discuss things with people. We try not to, we really don't, to blow people off or push them aside. We try and answer their questions. So I felt very, very bad. But this is somebody my employment's tied to. And I thought, oof. I said, he says, tell me about this Passover. What is this Passover? I said, well, you'd know it as communion. You take communion where you attend church? He says, yes, we do it every month. I said, well, we do it once a year. He said, only once a year? I said, yeah, it's only once a year. That's why it's called Passover. It's an annual event. It commemorates the Passover and Christ's Passover. And so I leave you with this conclusion. Passover is a simple, but singular and pivotal event. It is known by people all over the world. It is gaining understanding. But it is a pivotal event in history as it relates to God's people. And we understand that. Passover's meaning and importance carries through every facet of the Bible. Its concepts, its typology, all the way into the New Testament and Christ's observance, Christ's sacrifice in the fullness of the meaning of the time of Passover and the days of unleavened bread. When you observe Passover this year, and the conduct for the United Church of God is that we would prefer greatly that you are a baptized member to partake of the symbols of the bread and the wine. We think they're that important, that you are baptized. And when you observe Passover this year, you enter into history, a history that has been connected for thousands of years to God's people. It is a continual observance and meaning. And you will, as Christ's disciples, sit at a very, very simple table, with very, very simple means before you. You see in the pews in front of you, most of you do, the little holders for the cups. The church that meets here uses them quite often. We will use them once. We use them once a year. It's that important to us. So at this very simple table, you will renew the covenant that has existed for thousands and thousands of years. But you have been given an understanding of its deepest meaning for you collectively, us as a church, and you individually as a human being. Because God does not save organizations. He saves people. So when we come to Passover this year, remember the continuity and the history of that event. I don't know when you or we enter Passover season. I think we kind of entered it a little early this year. But then again, it's kind of like the Feast of Tabernacles. Maybe we should be thinking about Passover a lot during the year. That one event in the spring where we renew the observance and we again enter history.